Your Notre Dame football weekend starts now on Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT. This is the Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. Now your hosts, Sean Stiers and former Irish quarterback Evan Sharpley.
Welcome back. We've been gone for a while.
Yeah.
It's not like nothing's happened since we've been gone, I guess, either, huh?
Quite a bit, actually.
Man. I mean, it seems like it's been a month since Monday's Citrus Bowl at this point.
What the heck happened?
I know. I mean, the list of things, obviously, and if you're a Notre Dame fan, I mean, you know what's happened, but I'll just recount it for you. I mean, the two big pieces of news for Notre Dame football yesterday, the bombshell, originally Mike Elko spurns Texas A&M to become their new defensive coordinator, but then yesterday afternoon, not quite 24 hours ago, the news comes that he's decided to accept what's reported to be a roughly $2 million a year defensive coordinator position. That's, you know, just a little chunk of change, even for the SEC. But so he's going to leave Notre Dame, take that job. A few hours later, wide receiver Equanimeous St. Brown announces that he's leaving 2 years of eligibility on the table to enter the NFL draft, which will be in just a few months. And then, of course, this is all after you had the quarterback situation on Monday,
lost
obviously
in the
Citrus
Bowl. Dave Belue's gone as well. As he's,
that's right.
He took the strength
going down
coach
to Indiana.
And, yeah.
Yep.
I think that's a big loss, too.
It is.
So all that came to mind, because I was down at the ABCA baseball convention in Indy yesterday. I was speaking, was the scene in Dumb and Dumber where they says we got no food, we got no job, and our heads are falling off. Like, it was like I leave town and all this stuff happens. It's unbelievable.
Oh man. And then of course also, so the basketball news, major basketball news happened this week as well, with Bonzi Colson
right
fracturing his foot. He's going to be out at least 2 months. And so then Matt Farrell sprains his ankle just 15 minutes into the first half against NC State the other night.
And listening to
basketball
Bray
team, everything
night,
went fine.
He's thinking that it might be the season.
For Farrell?
For Colson.
I was going to say, yeah, for Colson.
It was more about, you know, discussing what his future would be,
right,
you know, with the NBA and making sure that he's making a good long-term decision.
Yeah.
They're not going to rush him back by any means.
No, and I heard that as well, where he was saying, specific to the fracture in Colson's foot, that if it's a softer surface, like football, right, grass, turf, the softer turf, obviously, that it can be maybe 6 weeks, but because it's a hard surface, you're pounding on the floor 8 weeks minimum. So, and then he said they're going to adhere to that.
I got to say, what's more amazing is that there's been 4 ACL tears for the women's team.
Now, let me get your take, because
yeah, I wanted to talk about this.
Having been, you know, over there doing play-by-play for women for 8 years previously, I mean, those kind of tears are more prominent in female athletes.
Correct.
First of all.
Yes.
But and I know that a lot of people want to start pointing a finger right away, and you're involved in strength and conditioning and all that, but female athletes are far more susceptible to ACL tears
than
men.
And that starts with just how their bodies are.
Yeah.
The hip alignment is a little bit different than men. So the ACL is much more at risk as far as the change of direction, the soft tissue injuries. However, you know, paired with a training program that maybe doesn't have a lot of focus on deceleration, which I'm not 100% sure, you know, how these ladies are training. If they aren't doing a lot of the deceleration drills or learning to properly land, learning to properly absorb the energy that they're creating and then transferring it in a healthy manner, you know, in an opposite direction, you could make those already, you know, those areas already susceptible to a tear even more. And I think that could be part of, you know, what you're seeing. And again, I'm not behind the scenes, so I'm not, yeah, I can only speculate at this point too. And it's likely not right to point the finger, but it could be a little bit of both. And I think when you see this many number of tears, and, you know, maybe we look 3 or 4 years ago, Notre Dame football team, how many soft tissue injuries there were, and then a reevaluation, because the strength and conditioning and performance side of things is always evolving. There's always new material. There's new ways to approach things. And if you aren't looking at those, if you're a traditionalist and you're really focusing on what has always been and you're not adding, it doesn't mean that everything new is right, but there certainly are going to be some aspects that you should take advantage of to make sure that, you know, the athletes that you're training are going to be well-rounded, are going to stay healthy, and are going to, you're trying to decrease that risk of injury. Although, you know, any sport you play, there's going to be some level of risk.
Yeah, and sometimes things just happen. And when you have four on one team, you want to say, well, is there a trend here? But at the same time, it could just be four completely unrelated, unfortunate accidents.
Like I said, you know, looking back to Notre Dame a few years ago, I think that was one side of it was, are these freak injuries, or is there something a little bit more to it? And there very well could be in this regard too. And it doesn't mean that the staff is necessarily dropping the ball. It could be, you know, maybe a reevaluation period now on, are there some holes in the type of training that we're doing? It doesn't mean that what they're doing was wrong. They're probably doing some great things, but are there areas now that we can close the gap where this isn't going to happen four times? I mean, if you look at most teams, you're probably, especially on the female side, you're going to see, I would say, probably a knee per team a year. And that's unfortunate, but it does happen quite a bit. And you see it a lot of times in the hard pounding change of direction sports. You know, you see it in soccer quite a bit. You see it in girls basketball as well. So, you know, it's going to be a period of time on answering the question on why exactly is this happening? Because, you know, one, okay, four, it's a different story. I think then you probably do start to see a pattern and things need to be reevaluated a little bit.
Yeah, I think you always need to reevaluate, even if it's only two, even if it's only one. You still have to go back and look at what you're doing. Specific to football, we know that there's been a lot of science brought in. I don't know how much of that's going on with the other sports right now, but I know they're obviously all working over there, doing their best to try to prevent this kind of stuff from happening. But we just don't know.
And I'll tell you what, it puts them in a tough hole.
Yeah, now they've got seven scholarship athletes. I mean, they've been plugging away, but I mean, attrition is attrition. So, you know, and I know what, I guess it's been 20 some years ago. I mean, that team got a little bit depleted with some injuries. That was Neil Ivey on that Final Four team, and I'm not talking about the national championship. Prior to that, early in her career, she tore an ACL. She was able to come back from it. She's obviously part of the staff now, but it ended up being sort of a long haul to find the silver lining. But because of that injury that she suffered earlier in her career, she was part of the 2001 mm-hmm. national championship team because she got that extra year of eligibility on the back end.
I mean, it was interesting. I know this is on the opposite side. This is the men's team, but just listening to Coach Bray last night on his weekly show on, you know, other players have to step up. You can't sit and wait around for somebody to make you feel better.
That's right.
There's still games that are going to be
played. And playing. They did. They did step up.
And, you know, it's an opportunity for other players now. You know, this could be their moment, whether, you know, you're hoping that they're ready for it. Maybe some of them aren't, but they're going to be thrust in a position where they're going to have to start making plays.
Doesn't matter if they're ready. You're on scholarship. It's go time now.
It is go time.
And everybody's got to chip in, especially now that you're down both Colson as well as Matt Farrell. But we've got some of the audio from the coach's show. If we have time, we'll get to that in a little bit. Of course, Sean and Sharpley and the Leprechaun Lunch is presented by Sharpley Training. With us, you can be a champion. Call today for a complimentary class, 574-226-8234. You can also visit sharpleytraining.com, and we'll talk some more training stuff later if we have time, because we have, as we mentioned, so much stuff to get to. And let's start with Mike Elko, the defensive coordinator. I mean, he came in, it's only been a little bit more than a year, came in, completely revitalized the Fighting Irish defense with his 4-2-5 scheme, and just across the board statistically, from points a game to yardage, turnovers caused, sacks, everything else, they were so much better. But Mike Elko takes this job. Again, he was originally offered a pretty good chunk of money from Texas A&M. He turned it down. Notre Dame upped the ante. But after LSU's defensive coordinator turned Jimbo Fisher and Texas A&M down to get reportedly $2.5 million a year down there. Texas A&M came at Mike Elko again, and they made him an offer that he obviously couldn't refuse. So just your thoughts on that.
I mean, I tweeted this out in October, the end of October.
Pay him what Mike he wants. I saw that, and that holds up well.
Whatever he wants, you give it. Got to give it to him.
Yeah.
I mean, let's, you know, we could ask this question right now. You know, if he's not the defensive coordinator this year, what's Notre Dame's record?
Yeah.
Because going into the season, the defense was still the biggest question mark in my mind.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't have said that the offense would have maybe been as inconsistent up and down. In some of the bigger games, I guess I would say, and the defense played the way that they did, and especially early on. I didn't see it happening the way it would have against Georgia. I wouldn't have seen some of the dominating performances during that first half of the season. I wouldn't have seen what happened against USC. Never would have predicted that in a million years before the season started. Not with the number of guys that were coming back and a brand new scheme. So that speaks a lot to what? The new people that were there making the changes. So
absolutely.
Yes, they are gone. He's gone now. Okay, so it's got to be what is the next step? Because you don't want to have a third defense now in 3 years. That's not good. So
especially when as many guys excelled in this
absolutely
defense as they did.
You look at guys who revitalized their career. Number of guys.
Drew Tranquil.
Yeah, Andrew Tombetti's another guy too who had a very solid year. Jay Hayes is another one too. And you look at like Tavon Coney who has a breakout year. Who was riding Pine the year before?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the key now, as far as this next step goes, is are they going to be able to hold on to Clark Lee? And I don't know.
Well, let me ask you this then. So, I mean,
you think
the number one priority right now needs to be keeping this scheme in place? You absolutely think
I would offer Clark Lee the defensive coordinator job.
You would.
I would offer him the job
over Mike Elston.
I love Mike. That's not any offense to him, but you better believe if Texas A&M comes in and they're going to offer Clark Lee a position at Texas A&M, mm-hmm. he's probably going to get paid more money than he would be at Notre Dame, and wouldn't it make sense for him to continue to follow a guy to run the
pretty
same
strong
scheme,
track record
right?
of that already based
okay.
on what's going on. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
go ahead.
I feel like the scheme would disappear if he does.
That's what, and I know Eric Hansen talked a little bit about this yesterday, that you could keep the scheme by making Mike Elston the defensive coordinator.
Not his, it's not his scheme.
That's
though.
Right, because Clark Lee still knows, and we talked about this, I think, on Game Day Sports Beat on Monday, that we talked about the fact that Elko was going to stay because just 4 days ago we thought he was going to, that now, okay, you've got the scheme in place, you did all this work, you built all this up, and now this offseason becomes more about nuance and really
sure.
being particular with some things that you can really
but
still continue to elevate it. But yeah, you're exactly
right. If
you're
Mike Elston and you are the coordinator,
that's right.
and you're saying we're running Elko's defense, who are you going to look to?
It's one thing to know the X's and O's, but Lee is the guy who knows the nuance now.
Absolutely.
That's right.
He's got and again, I don't know if it's the right thing to do when you have a guy like Mike Elston who's been at Notre Dame, right? He's survived a couple of the coaching changes. This last year, I think was probably the best that he's coached a group since he's been at Notre Dame. Unbelievable turnaround from the defensive line. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
What he would feel like? Would he be able to accept that? But if this scheme is going to stay in place. If Lee's gone, that scheme is gone. And we don't really know what a Mike Elston scheme would look like. We don't. I haven't sat down and asked him. Would there be carryover? I don't know.
It's not unusual at the Division I level to have co-coordinators. Could you see something like that happening here? Because of the fact you've got this guy with a ton of seniority on the staff. He's an assistant head coach.
Sure.
Right now, he was elevated to that position. I'm talking about Mike Elston. He was elevated to that position. The next natural progression for him is to become a defensive coordinator. I mean, he's been around long enough that's the next natural thing that's going to happen. And if he doesn't get it here, then I would imagine
who calls
then
the
you
defense,
start looking around.
I think
yeah,
is the question I would ask.
Right, but you have one who's in charge of one element, and you've got another guy who's in charge of another. I think I want to say that Brent Venables, when he was at Oklahoma early in his career, because he was obviously he's still fairly young right now. He's just a few years younger than me. He actually, we're from the same hometown. I used to play football against his older brother. So, and he was kind of one of these, he was a walk-on at Kansas State. But not to digress into him, but he was a co-coordinator early on in his career before he became Brent Venables' highly sought-after guy.
I don't think it's uncommon. On the offensive side, I've liked that less when you have like a run game coordinator and a pass game coordinator. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what would be important would be is making sure that the structure is set up in a way where the roles are clearly defined. And again, if you have a guy who came in with a defense, it's more Clark Lee's defense than it would be Mike Elston's,
right?
As far as the scheme is concerned. Really the beauty in the scheme is who's calling the plays and who's getting the guys into the correct position to make those plays. And that's been the MO of Mike Elko since he was at Bowling Green, since he was at Wake Forest. It was the tendencies of we're going to bring this pressure in this situation. And the guy, you know, the players spoke to that. It was, we now have a philosophy on first down, second down, third down. We know what we're doing in those situations.
I talked to Clark Lee back in August. It was on the media day.
I had a great conversation with him, too. It was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, he'll sit down and you got
talk shop for...
Exactly.
Probably talk shop all day.
That's right. So here's just a quick comment that Clark Lee had about one of the great strengths of Mike Elko.
You know, he is as good as I've been around from a standpoint of identifying opponent weaknesses and trying to expose them, or identifying matchup issues and trying to make sure that we put ourselves in the best possible position we can be in. And so a lot of that comes through in our game planning or our meeting as coaching, how we set the defense up, and then certainly in how he teaches the defense to the kids. And I feel like, you know, coming out of fall camp, these kids will be set up well, understanding situations, understanding offensive mindsets, and then at the end of the day, they'll play with confidence on the field because they know the call that's coming in is meant to put them in the best possible position to win.
So there's Clark Lee talking about that, about how Elko, I mean, that was the big thing with him. And again, because Clark Lee has that background, that doesn't mean he'll be the same, but at least he has a much more detailed working knowledge about how Mike Elko went about setting those things up.
He was a really fun guy to watch in practice, too. He had a very different approach than, you know, even when I played 10 years ago. And it was very much like he approached his position group and coaching the linebackers. Granted, they're on a field, but it was almost like a classroom setting. You know, there were times to yell, but most of the instruction was very calculated, was very concise. It was almost like a conversation not between player and coach, but two peers. And I think the players really respected that because it was less about hurry up and understand this versus, from Lee's perspective, how can I better help you understand this? And really, that was something that was brought from the top down, and in my mind was a huge reason for why the turnaround was so quick. You have a lot of smart guys at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. if you can still simplify things for them and make them understand and then let their natural athleticism play through, you're going to see the type of plays that they made this year. You know, talking best and worst case scenarios, what would be your best case scenario now here with the current staff that is there? What would, if you're in the position of power to try to, let's forget about the offense right now, let's just focus on the defense, because in my mind, that's for lasting success for the next 3 to 5 years, that's where it's going to occur. Because there's been so much turnover over the last 3 years. You go from Brian Van Gorder to an interim coach to, you know, basically an entire shakeup, and now you're one guy, and we're talking Lee, one guy away from leaving to back to square one of where you were last January. Do we have to hear what happened last January again for another? That might be the case. what would be your best case scenario right now as a next step? And then what would be your worst case scenario? Do you have a backup plan?
Man. Best case, the defense stays in place, and I agree with what you're saying.
Are you going to go with Elston as this, as the...
I don't know. See, that's that's one of those behind closed doors dynamics.
Right.
We don't know, because I mean, really, we know that Mike Elston interviewed
sure.
for the defensive coordinator position.
And would the conversation then be, if you offer it to Lee, is Elston saying, well...
Right.
Do I have the opportunity to keep climbing?
Because here? Mike Elston was still a big part, no matter what Mike Elko brought to this thing. Mike Elston was a big piece when he went back to work with the defensive
line this year. Yeah.
A really big piece of the success of this team as well with the work that he did specific with the defensive line.
So yeah, I think, and I'm kind of digging on, you know, what you're saying as far as, you know, having Elston as the defensive coordinator. But if you're going to continue running this same Elko-esque scheme, if Lee is in place, he's got to get a promotion.
Right.
Okay. He's got to get a pay increase for him to stay.
Right.
And then I believe then the play calling has to go to him, because he's going to have, at least in my mind, a better feel for the tendencies that he's seen over the past 3 to 5 years with Elko.
Do you see if Clark Lee was promoted, and I've seen at least a couple other guys on the beat kind of thinking along the same lines that maybe he does need to be. Do you see any downside to the fact that you've got a relatively young position coach who would be elevated to a coordinator position?
I'm sure there's some risk. I mean, it'd be like, you know, you're the backup quarterback and now you're QB1. The lights are brighter. There's more scrutiny. I wouldn't be concerned about it. You know, being around him, the knowledge base that he has, the respect I think that he's garnered from his players.
He's roughly 35 years old. Just looking at his bio, that's about what he is right now. 35 years old. I mean, Sean McVay, the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams, I think is a little bit younger than that. And
yeah.
They're going to the playoffs in his first year.
They are. Well, wild card this weekend, yeah?
Right.
Okay. I don't know, you know, so that's where I am. That's my thought, is if you want to have, you know, cohesion from this past year, Clark Lee is the piece. If he's gone,
you're looking for a new defense.
What is your next step? Then do you put the pieces together around Elston, or are you going to now, you know, have an outside hire again? That's going to bring in a new defense.
Well, and the fact that Clark Lee is also a linebacker, I think that, well, I guess he played fullback, but he's a linebacker coach. I mean, don't you think that sort of plays into it as well with the calls and just the whole thing
from that position? The calls are coming from the middle there. And part of the conversation, you played some of the tape from the media day, and, you know, I had a very interesting conversation as far as how, you know, the mic and the buck work. And he said they're very interchangeable. Everybody needs to know what to do. There's communication between everyone. Now, certainly the mic is going to be, you know, the guy that a lot of players are going to be looking to. But, you know, that middle group, the linebacker, you know, they're really setting the tone as far as, you know, run fills and communicating with the defensive line what they're seeing, and then making sure that, you know, the coverage behind them is getting set up in a way that is going to protect the front seven as well. So, that's, you know, as soon as I saw this news, number one was should have paid him more. And then number two is what is going to happen next? Because there's got to be cohesion from this past year to the next year. How do you bridge that gap? How do you put not even maybe band-aid? How can you stitch it up so that there then is a healing process between 2017 and 2018?
Let me go to your first comment there about paying him more, and I agree. And they did try, right? The SEC right now is paying assistant coaches. I mean, they're paying assistant coaches more than anybody else in the country. That's right. I mean, Jimbo Fisher is getting close to $80 million over what? I think it's 7 years, or is it 10 years?
It might be 10.
Whatever it is,
he's getting a lot of money.
But in any case, he's getting a lot of money. They're going to pay a lot of money, and I realize a lot of fans are upset that Notre Dame didn't just open up the vault and pay Mike Elko whatever he wanted. I mean, everyone, there has to be a cap on everything. You can't just even, yeah, there's money over there at Notre Dame, and a lot of fans have brought that up too, but
$1.8 million.
You have to have an end point.
One penny.
It can't just be unlimited, right? I mean, you can't pay, you couldn't jack this up to $4 million a year just to keep Mike Elko.
If you see the value,
the look
in it,
on your
face. I mean, so like, you know, when my whole thought on this was what value, what I saw this year was pretty amazing. I don't know if, and let's rewind to 2016. Let's rewind there. 4-8. How many of those guys from that defensive unit return in 2017? Quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of loss. So you're talking about the same defense. Now, granted, it was a different scheme, but we're talking about a lot of the same players that came back in 2017. And what they did this year, in my mind, was just short of amazing. Granted, who was back and what they did the year before.
So you're saying,
pay the man his money.
Unlimited.
Why not?
Even if it was $10 million
a
year.
What's the goal?
I'll just keep picking numbers. I mean, there's got to be a cutoff point.
Is the goal to win national championships?
Well, sure. But that doesn't mean that you're just going to throw unlimited money at assistant coaches either.
I still think it would be fun to see, though. How high would Texas A&M go? Where were they going
to
stop?
But the thing is, with Notre Dame, they don't even have to tell anybody what the money was, right?
Well, I'm sure it could be endowed by somebody. Because each coach, the defensive coordinator, offense coordinator, and head coach, right? There's a name for the coach, right? Is that it's
right?
Brought
endowment.
To you by somebody.
But you can't be George Costanza's assistant making more than George Costanza, right?
Right.
The traveling secretary,
right?
Yeah, the assistant can't make more than the head coach.
I agree that there probably is a line. I think it's one of those maybe you draw the line in pencil. And you erase it a couple of times.
Yeah, but and they may have already.
And they did, and that information has come out that they made counter actions as far as trying to make the deal a little bit sweeter. And I think too, you know, how could you add? What would be other options to add more value? I don't know that conversation. Yeah. All I know is
you can't offer ownership stake like the right. Raiders supposedly did with Gruden.
all I know is. I was overly impressed, number one, from the conversations and talking with him when he first came in. And then I was a doubter. There's 100%. I would be the first to tell you, I wouldn't have ever thought the defensive turnaround would have happened like it did and so fast.
But you're equally as impressed with Kirk Lee. Is that fair?
Clark, I probably spent a little more time with Clark during media day than Coach Elko. But both of them, you know, they're very, very down to earth, very, very cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the way that they communicate is very simple too.
All right, we're going to talk about Equanimeous St. Brown next. We're going to take a timeout. We'll talk about his decision to go to the NFL as Evan opens up his vault and wheels in as much money as he can find to sign everybody. Who is worthy of staying?
Start a GoFundMe page.
That's right.
I'm sure the fans would chip in too.
That's right. But we'll also talk about when we come back, kind of continuing this as we segue into Equanimeous St. Brown.
What happens with Tillery and Coney?
And Coney being the big one. How much is he tied to what might happen with Clark Lee?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that coming up right after this. It is coming up on 12:29. Sean and Sharpley Leprechaun Lunch on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. I had a feeling Evan needed some good vibrations.
You're really getting me in the mood now.
That's right. Gotta make him happy once again. Sean and Sharpley on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. Brought to you by Sharpley. Training with us, you can be a champion. Call today for a complimentary class, 574-226-8234. Visit sharpleytraining.com. All right, so we did some fact-checking during our break there, and it was Jimbo Fisher. 10 years, $75 million he got. So nearly $80 million, Jimbo Fisher. And it's all guaranteed as well. He would not leave any of it on the table if he gets fired or whatever. Dave Aranda, the LSU defensive coordinator who got his money upped to stay, reportedly $2.5 million per year for him. Ed Orgeron, the head coach, is making $3.5 million. So the defensive coordinator will make about $1 million less per year at LSU than the head coach.
I wonder if that gap is going to continue to close.
Man.
Is it happening? I don't know. I don't think it's not happening on the offensive side of the ball, though, is it?
I don't think so.
It's those.
I mean, the Big 12 is the one who needs to be paid. Defensive coordinators.
Those defensive coordinators. I mean, that's it right now. You know, if you have the hot ticket as far as, you know, what you're doing on the defensive side, and you're stopping people from scoring, because that's been the trend, is there's been so many points given up. But if you can stop, you know, that's why Don Brown is one of the hot guys at Michigan. That's why Arenda's getting paid. That's why Elko just got paid a bunch.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, just look at Georgia.
Yeah.
Kirby Smart, they're built on defense, obviously. And really,
minus this last game,
for the most part, Alabama is as well.
That was pretty impressive, their stoppage of Clemson. Did you watch the game before it?
I watched the first game. I didn't watch as much of the second game because I had to get up and be JT Tuesday morning.
Yeah, that's right.
But yes, I watched the first semifinal. That was one of the most entertaining games I can remember. I told Darren this the other day. I put that game right behind the USC Texas game back in 2005, the national championship.
That was a good
Vince
game
Young
too.
Both in the Rose Bowl too.
And so what was really cool is I watched it. I watched on SkyCam. And so
that's right. That was the other channel with the, was that like the Coach's Corner or something?
I was actually watching, I was streaming it from my computer. And what it is it's the camera that, you know, that floats above the stadium on the little lines.
So you could watch it all on that.
But how they have it set up, which I love, is it's from behind the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting, you know, the behind the end zone cut, but right above the quarterback's head. So you're getting to see alignment from the defensive fronts. You can see formations from the offense versus the side view. And as a number one, as a former player, it's really cool. But if you're watching it as a fan, you understand then why the decisions sometimes are made that you can't understand. Because the side view up high, everything looks great. You know, when I'm sitting up in the press box, you know, during the season watching, it's like, how do you miss a guy that wide open? How are you not making that check or that read?
Uh-huh.
You know, when you get behind, you see the speed, number one, of how fast those things are occurring. And then you can understand, too, some of the angles maybe that guys are seeing. But what I liked is it's all natural sound. So you've got no commentators talking. All it is the live feed. So you're hearing the fans, you're hearing the band, you're hearing the cadence, you're hearing the calls.
And you see
all
it from
that stuff
right behind the quarterback.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I'm sure they'll have that for the national championship
it's
game.
It's a neat way to watch it. The only problem was in the second game, because I was pretty tired like you, because there's nobody talking, I just started to kind of doze off.
Yeah, see, so there actually is a purpose for those announcers sometimes.
Keep me awake.
Tell you a few things. Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, you dummy. All right.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, it is 12:36. Now, we'll talk about Equanimeous St. Brownie here in a second. I wanted to, as I said, ask you, okay, we've been talking about Clark Lee and his importance to this defense. Tavon Coney, like Equanimeous St. Brown did, got to go back to school grade from the NFL Draft Advisory Board. But he has still not announced what he is going to do. How much of what Coney might do, whether he declares or stays, do you think might be tied to whether Clark Lee stays or goes somewhere?
I think it'd play a pretty big role. I mean, I don't think that Coney has the season he has this year without Elko and Lee.
Yeah.
So I think that will be, I don't know if it'll be the deciding factor, but I think it'll certainly play into it.
I think that Coney, I understand why he got to go back to school grade. Now, I've got a clip from Charlie Campbell from WalterFootball.com here that I'll play on Equanimeous St. Brown in a minute. But Charlie talks to, in addition to doing his own game film breakdown and all that kind of stuff, he talks to NFL scouts, gets feedback, and that's how they put together their mock mm-hmm. drafts and things like that. And he said he was not hearing a whole lot on Tavon Coney. He did a little bit during the season, but by the end, he was not hearing that much. when you look at him, and I realize you haven't sat and broken down film on Coney. I mean, obviously he led the team in tackles, had 17 in the Citrus Bowl, had a great Citrus Bowl, but it looks like, especially for his position, the pass coverage element might be the one thing he could really improve on if he comes back for another year.
That'd be the biggest question mark in my mind, and I think probably in pro scouts' minds too, but also, you know, limited film. And we're talking really one season body of work.
Right.
You know, I think that'd be another, you know, question mark for teams is, you know, what do we project his ceiling to be only having seen him play 1 year? Granted, it was a great year. You know, how does that factor in long term? Is he a guy that we're going to take a shot on thinking that his ceiling could be higher, or is this what we're going to see? But I think to your point, you know, if he solidifies things in coverage too, he's going to be, you know, he's going to be a better two-way guy as far as being able to, you know, stop the run laterally. He's got, you know, pretty good lateral speed, but then also being able to match up with some guys in space too.
Absolutely. So now Equanimeous has declared for the NFL draft,
which means his brother's not coming to Notre Dame.
Right. I mean, there can't be any way, I would think, and he's supposed to announce on Monday. But he got a back to school evaluation as well. Equanimeous went from 58 catches, 961 yards, 9 touchdowns last year with Deshaun Kizer pulling the trigger. Deshaun didn't have a great rookie season by any means with Cleveland. He was still a more pro-style, pro-ready quarterback than what we saw this year when Equanimeous' numbers went down. 33 catches, 515 yards, 4 touchdowns all season. He had 2 catches for 47 yards in the Citrus Bowl. And I mentioned Charlie Campbell, so I'll just let you hear some of his thoughts. And this is from roughly 3 weeks ago, some of Charlie Campbell's thoughts on Equanimeous St. Brown.
Even before the season started, I was in my preseason study. I was really impressed with what he did a year ago when he had Deshaun Kizer at quarterback. And I thought that, you know, this guy has a world of ability in terms of size. He can run for that size too. You know, often you see big receivers coming to the NFL, but they don't have the quickness to run after the catch or to get open and get separation. And you saw that with St. Brown in the 2016 tape. And then fast forward to this year, you saw flashes of it. You know, late in the year, he has a huge game, you know, and there are other games in the year where you saw him getting open and you saw that they couldn't, you know, Wimbush was struggling to get him the ball, the completion percentage and the accuracy were, you know, problems that plagued the Irish all season long, and that really hurts a player like St. Brown. I think it also kind of led to some drops that he had just in the, you know, not being able to really get in much of a rhythm all year when he only has 31 receptions at the end of the regular season. So just that combination of size and speed is in demand, and this isn't a very strong receiver draft, and obviously that's a top need in the passing-driven NFL. So it wouldn't surprise me if he works out well, he ends up going higher than it thought. I've had some teams say they still think he has a shot at late first round. Others see him going day two. So he's kind of on that bubble. But you can't coach 6'5 and, you know, 200-some pounds with quickness. That just, you know, is a God-given ability he has. So if he enters the draft, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets late one consideration. If he does go to day two, I don't think he'll have that long of a wait.
And again, that's Charlie Campbell from WalterFootball.com. They put together mock drafts, evaluate players throughout the year, and in addition to their own eyes, breaking down film, they get feedback from NFL scouts making their evaluations. Their latest mock had Equanimeous, and this is before Equanimeous declared, they had him going 48th, so basically middle of the second round. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could see second to third round, even though, again, the advisory board, the grades you get, first round, second round, go back to school. But apparently somebody still likes Equanimeous. Just some of your thoughts when hearing that and looking at the decision.
I liked that write-up right there. I was a lot of those talking points I would agree with. I think that, you know, this season didn't do him any favors, certainly, and that I think that's probably the taste in, you know, most people's mouths, maybe outside of you know, some pro teams that had been interested prior to this season. You know, what he did last year on a team that wasn't very good was pretty impressive. I think that, you know, the inconsistency and inability to, you know, complete passes this year was a huge detriment. And they're really, you know, you never really felt that really good chemistry the whole year between the quarterback position and the wide receivers, really at any level. There, again, when I sound like a broken record, we say it every week, there were glimpses, but there was never consistency.
But the one thing that Equanimeous didn't do enough of, it seems like, is what we saw from Miles Boykin on a couple of catches the other day. The first one was down the left sideline. He's sitting there right between two defenders. He didn't have to make a spectacular play like he did on the last one, but I mean, just his physical size and presence allowed him to...
Let me just get your take on this. Do you think that there were passes in that radius that he could have caught?
St. Brown?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, I can't sit here and tell you, you know, which game and what instance they happened in, but I felt like there were some of those kind of balls that, because, I mean, because we're talking about now, typically in college, you're going to have more separation than you do in the NFL. And there are fewer open windows in the NFL than there are in college. So even if you have a quarterback that's not overly accurate, it would seem like St. Brown should have had more catches this year.
I can agree with that. And I think, too, you know, everyone was talking about how good of a catch it was. I was like, man, that was a darn good throw. You know, you have a guy with that type of, and I don't think that Winbush utilized the back shoulder enough.
That's true too.
You know, I felt at times it was he was trying to be so perfect. This ball has to be right here in, you know, right in stride. So it was either overthrown or it was even too high. Just put it in the vicinity. These guys are 6'5", 6'6".
That's fair, too.
Their catch radius, you know, is massive, both those guys. And that, you know, that's what I was pretty impressed with is, you know, Book made a quick decision. He got off of his initial read, and then, man, he let that ball go.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, at that point, as the quarterback, you're saying, dude, you better make that catch. As good of a catch as that was, it was in his catch radius, so he should catch it.
Well, and it's also because of St. Brown. That's why Miles Boykin didn't see as much time this year, and we've already seen.
Still, I mean, surprised.
But we saw in that game a lot of the things that we saw from Boykin in spring last year. So
I'll tell you what, I was, and I know this with, you know, hindsight's 20/20 now, but I was excited during the spring to see Boykin, Claypool, and St. Brown all in that same lineup with, you know, with a mixture maybe of Fink in the slot a little bit. And, you know, at that point, you know, Stepherson wasn't in the mix, but, you know, at least having maybe that as an X factor, which wasn't going to happen until five games in the season anyways. But with the size of those guys, you know, I think that there was a lot of excitement. Now with him out of the picture, you know, and Stepherson out of the picture and Sanders grad transferring, what are your options now looking at as far as you're going to have Claypool back, granted, you know, how quickly he's healthy following surgery. Boykin's another guy who's going to be in the mix as well. Mm-hmm. And then you're probably going to have quite a few younger guys needing to step up. Javon McKinley, you know, he might be another name that's going to be in there as well. But then you basically got, you know, you really have a new crop of players. Michael Young is going to be another one that's going to need to step up. We saw Jafar Armstrong a little bit in fall camp as well. I don't know. We might have a couple of new faces that we don't really know about that are going to be emerging as guys that are going to be, you know, in some pretty big roles.
Absolutely. And just kind of a final thought on Equanimeous, because I know a lot of fans are doubting. I mean, I saw some people even saying, "Oh, well, good luck being an undrafted free agent." I mean, he's coveted by,
and Papa Brown's going to have him ready. You better believe.
That's right. And so, I mean, you can't just look at production on the field. There are a lot of other elements that you hit there.
And his grade right now is what, mid second round,
right?
And that's before pro day and before the combine.
Yeah,
I bet he tests pretty well.
I think he'll
run well. I think he'll jump well. And I think then when you get in a setting like a pro day, and he might catch passes at the combine too. I don't know what he'll do, you know, where he'll run. Mm-hmm. Most guys, because he'll be a combine invite guy, he'll probably test at the combine, do all the testing, do the interviews. And then I would assume maybe that he'd hold out and maybe not run routes and then run routes at pro day.
With who?
Me.
There you go.
I put my name in the hat every year.
All right.
I did it for John Goodman and Tyler Eifert.
That's
man,
right.
I was locked in.
We still haven't talked much about the quarterback situation. I'm going to take a quick.
Weren't we trying to? We're trying to wait like a month or two, right?
I know. Man, what happened there? Going to take a quick break. We'll come back and hit that. Ian Book, Brandon Wimbush, all that. We'll do that next. Sean and Sharpley, Leprechaun Lunch on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. Well, the hits just keep on coming. It's 10 minutes away from 1 o'clock. Sean and Sharpley on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. We talked about Equanimeous St. Brown. He declared it yesterday, and now, so after Mike Elko leaves for Texas A&M, takes the money, Equanimeous St. Brown says, I'm going to the NFL, and now, just within the last few minutes, Notre Dame running back Josh Adams has also declared for the NFL draft.
Yeah.
So you're just kind of looking in disbelief.
So
I mean,
Clark,
I think
so
this
then
is the
Clark
one.
Clark Lee will be later today, right? and then what would be the natural progression of things from there?
Oh,
Coney and Tillery? I don't know.
Yeah.
How many wins are you at now next
I think,
year?
But I think these two offensive guys, I think these two offensive guys make the most sense. The two defensive guys, Tillery
I agree.
And Coney, I think they need to come back more.
So we're looking now next year at a Dexter Williams, Tony Jones Jr. backfield.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
There's nothing wrong with that at all.
What a great career for Josh, too. Awesome year this year. Minus the 33 trucking slogan.
Yeah. 1,430 yards. He finished 8 yards shy of the single-season Notre Dame rushing record. 9 touchdowns. He still averaged 6.9 yards per carry. Didn't have a great Citrus Bowl, but it just makes sense.
About Dexter Williams too. He was a carry away from qualifying
for
to
what?
Have the what like 9.8 yards per carry.
Yeah, 9.2 yards per carry, 4 more carries than he would have qualified for the national leaders in yards per carry. But I mean, you look at him, and again, there are people that look at that. One, you had Josh Adams. It's not like Josh Adams stunk the place up. He almost set the Notre Dame single-season rushing record, but still people wanted more of Dexter Williams. And I think you look at back-to-back plays in the Citrus Bowl. One, he goes, 30-some yards, and on the very next play, he misses a block in pass protection, and that's where he has to get better this offseason.
Absolutely. And, I mean, you know, I think the concerning thing is we've been saying that for a couple years now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was that keeping him off the field because he was a guy that was going to be a liability when the team passed?
Yeah, and I mean, you could throw him out there on first down, second down, whatever. But if that be just like when Daniel Smith used to be on the field, the wide receiver,
you knew it was a run.
You knew it was going to be a run play right away. And if that's the thing with Dexter Williams, I mean, you can't do that. You can't only have him on the field when it's going to be a run play. It's an easy tell. So he's got to get better in pass protection. Josh Adams, probably a third or fourth round guy, it sounds like. And again, I've related this to CJ Procise a couple of years ago, pretty much the exact same situation. I think CJ could have gotten better, would have been a better overall running back had he come back for another year. Maybe the same for Josh, but it just makes sense for him to go at this point because he's already been banged up a little bit.
His stock's high right now, too.
Right, exactly.
I don't know if another really good year next year would make it higher. I think it's probably the highest it's going to be unless he came back and, I guess, won the Heisman Trophy.
Yep.
But he's going to be competing for carries next year, too.
Want to get your take. So again, Josh Adams has declared for the NFL draft. Equanimeous St. Brown declared yesterday. So now that leaves just Tavon Coney and Jerry Tillery to make their decisions. One of the things that Charlie Campbell, we played a sign about Equanimeous St. Brown from WalterFootball.com, told me is a lot of guys come out before they should. And I think that's the biggest thing that Tavon Coney and Jerry Tillery have to look at, are they really ready? Because those positions are different in different situations than a wide receiver and a running back.
I think it would do them good to come back.
I think so too. Especially Tillery another year in the strength and conditioning program to become an even better, really a chance to be a really dominant defensive lineman if he comes back next year.
I think Adams and St. Brown can both go and compete.
Right.
Year one for playing time.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes left, and we haven't even touched on what, again, seems like a month ago now, but was just 4 days ago. Ian Book replaces Brandon Wimbush, hits Miles Boykin, game-winning touchdown pass in the Citrus Bowl. He goes 14 out of 19, 164 yards, two touchdowns, an interception. He completed 73% of his passes. That's the granted, it was just in a half, but still, that is the best mark for a Notre Dame quarterback this year. What did you think of first, the move to go to Book and then staying with Book in the Citrus Bowl?
I thought when they initially brought him in, it was a little bit of a head scratcher. It was a third down. It was a kind of a weird situation.
Right.
You know, if the plan was to play both guys, that was, at least in my mind, at least, you know, a weird entry point to the game. You know, maybe the next drive, a fresh set of downs. But granted, that's when it happened. You know, the offense really wasn't doing a whole lot. And Book came in and gave, you know, some energy, and they were able to move the ball a little bit, and, you know, just a tremendous job by him in the second half. And you know, I was messaging back and forth with his quarterback trainer, Will Hewlett, and he was, you know, he was pumped and psyched. And we had talked about Ian a little bit too, and, you know, the one knock, and I think you actually tweeted this too, was, you know, sometimes trying to put a ball where a ball shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to make plays. I mean, and there's no doubt in my mind that that's what he was trying to do, but there, you know, the ball, there was no chance that ball was getting completed.
Right.
You know, he was a 60, 70 plus percentage completion guy all through high school. And I think when he started against UNC, we talked about this too, that's, you know, that's the type of guy that he's always been. So I think that, you know, what you saw in this bowl game there in the second half is, you know, what he's capable of doing as far as spreading the football around, where it can be around that 70% mark. During this offseason, I think you're going to see, you know, the reps split, and what's, you know, what is it going to be in practice? You know, Brandon Wimbush, he's going to have to complete 70% of his passes to stay in line with what Book's going to do. If, you know, if they're head to head, I think you're going to see Brandon Wimbush again. If Brandon continues to be inconsistent completing the football, I think you're going to see Ian Book.
One thing interesting that you talked about, and we had Angelo DiCarlo on in the second hour of Sports Beat last night, and he talked about, it was interesting, being at the go-kart races, and we've heard about those go-kart races, right?
Yeah.
So you heard what he said. All these other guys are out there reckless, having fun, going crazy in the go-karts, and here's Brandon Wimbush, 10-2, and the most conservative guy on the track.
I don't know if there's much to read into that or not. I don't know.
See, I think that when you see guys out of their environment, that there are things that you can pick up from how they're.
Well, no doubt in my mind. And Angelo said this. Book's, I mean, he's a fearless guy. And when, you know, when he stepped on campus, he's shorter than what you would say most prototypical quarterbacks are. You wouldn't say, and I was joking with Tom Noy the other day, you would say he probably has sneaky athleticism, which I think he has plenty of athleticism, and he can make plays, extend
plays, and
run. There's
some code there, but you're right.
he has a little bit of chip on his shoulder, but he came in and said, you know, I don't care who's in front of me, he's going to go in and compete. And that's the type of guy he is.
And that's the thing that I said the other day, and now there's not a direct analogy here, but there, after watching Ian Book in the Citrus Bowl and watching Baker Mayfield right after him, I mean, there are some Mayfield kind of elements there.
They both have some moxie,
some confidence.
Sure.
Yeah. It's not where Mayfield crosses the line into cockiness, but there is.
Sometimes you got to have that.
There's some swagger there,
and
even just kind of the way they play the game. There, you can see some of that in him.
There's not a lot of doubt in his mind, and I think, you know, against UNC, you saw that there wasn't a deer in the headlights look. The moment wasn't too big, and that's what you want from a quarterback position.
And that's the one thing that he has had from the first time we saw him step on the field is he did not doubt himself.
Sure.
But what you said, that fatal flaw where he still can read the defenses a little bit better. You can't underthrow into that bracket.
He gets that rectified. You know, it's going to be an interesting offseason, as it always is.
Yep.
As this last 24 or 48 hours have proven.
And we have 30 seconds. Will anyone declare before we wrap things up?
I'm announcing. I'm throwing at the pro day.
All right. Evan Sharpley will be at pro day. I'll have my video recorder ready to go. We will have it all.
Do a breakdown. Video analysis.
Sounds good. Good to be back with you. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Sean and Sharpley brought to you by Sharpley Training. Don't forget, Budweiser's weekday sports beat 5 to 7 tonight here on WSBT South Bend.